Now, as I said at the end of Friday, liberalism was institutionalized through constitutional and parliamentary government on the one hand, and through respectability on the other. And if you found it in any way difficult to follow, then please read chapters 5 and 6 of my Culture of Western Europe. Now, constitutional government, then, the one institutionalization of liberalism, was the idea of laws and not of men. It was based, as I said earlier, on the contract theory of government. It was based on parliamentary government and political parties. And you might say the free play of interests and the free debate among men. The state and its organization ideally still had what you might call a negative function, what I've called the function of a night watchman. But indeed, laws and parliament were thought to be the right framework for progress. Progress which didn't depend on laws and parliament, but upon free debate, and on freedom of conscience, and on the separation of church and state, on the free play of interests and between individuals. But parliament and laws and constitutions would guarantee a harmony which I remind you would come into being anyhow, because it was basic to the universe. Liberals believed in the natural laws, in the natural laws at the reflection of God on earth, if you like, and therefore in an harmonious universe which would eventually come out through free debate and discussion, controlled, as it were, through parliaments and political parties and constitutions. Nevertheless, there were safeguards. There were safeguards for that, after all, middle class idea. One safeguard was the association of freedom and property that I've talked about. The idea which we've discussed all along, that freedom could only flourish on the basis of a certain amount of property, what I've called the yeoman ideal, the free peasant on his free acres. Yes, this kind of ideal is here very strong. You had it with the Jacobins in the French Revolution and afterwards. And it translates itself into the property franchise. That is, that only those could vote who indeed had property to appreciate freedom or to be rooted in freedom. And those who did not have property could not vote. So there was the property franchise. And there was, after all, also at the same time, good behavior and respectability. Now, you might say that the new middle class defined itself through the political theory that I've outlined, but it also defined itself through respectability. And in a sense, these two go hand in hand. And if you had a property franchise, it was also believed that in order to vote, in order to take part in the political process, you had to have a certain level of education. And that level of education, as you will see in a minute, meant a certain level of character formation, a certain level of education, if you like, to respectability, as you know already from your reading of Tom Brown which I have said before, you should read now. For I want to put it now a little differently. For if one guarantee of this kind of middle-class identity was parliamentary government and political parties and constitutions and laws and free debate and all of that, another one was the building of a new elite. And both the property franchise and especially the emphasis of education was to build a new elite. For the middle class was inheriting in England, to a lesser extent elsewhere, the mantle of the aristocracy after the French Revolution. And that meant that the middle classes had to build, or felt they had to build, an elite which could take over where, if you like, the aristocracy left off, or where the aristocracy had been tumbled from its pedestal. Now, much more could be said, but I won't. You can read about it in the Culture of Western Europe, about the constitutional pillar of liberalism. But there is one final remark I want to make. The guardian of this constitution are the lawyers. And the guardian of respectability were the doctors. And so lawyers and doctors become the essential guardians of middle-class self-identification. The lawyers as guardians of this whole complex of constitutions, of parliaments, of laws, of free debate, all of that, of the play of interest. The lawyers and the doctors, and we've talked about that already, as the guardians of respectability. So that you begin to have two relatively new professions, if you like, the lawyers and doctors moving to the center of middle-class life. And that is, of course, why all of you want to be lawyers and doctors. That's why they pay so well. So what you have, therefore, here are these new professions becoming essential to middle-class self-identification, the essence of middle-class identification. See? That's, after all, you must remember why every Jewish mother wants her son to be a lawyer and a doctor. It's not only that he can earn good money, but it's a way of assimilation. It's a way of getting in, of getting on the inside. If you're a lawyer and a doctor, you are guardian of middle-class self-identification. You have, as it were, the final assimilation. Now, of course, it's stupid. Neither thing you can bring with you if you have to flee the country. Let me tell you that right now. Kids sometimes come to me and want to be lawyers and doctors. I say, you're absurd. You may have to flee the country. Those are two things you can't take with you. Can't take with you. So, anyway. But people never look into the future anyhow. So, anyway. So that's all I want to say, that at the beginning you still have the lawyer and doctor coming into the center. Now liberals linked political progress and spiritual enlightenment, or moral betterment, or respectability. If I can cite the great philosopher Kant, who in a sense stands at the beginning of this middle class development. Political change is a process of opinion formation. But opinion formation he defined as moral betterment. And moral betterment is accomplished through education. So political change is a process of opinion formation, which is moral betterment, accomplished through education. And that was crucial, because it is through education then that you can participate in the political process. And the importance that liberalism attached through voluntary participation in the political process, I have mentioned to you before. It is voluntary participation in the political process which reconciles the individual and the state. Voluntarism, which de Tocqueville stressed as the spirit of government, which John Stuart Mill stressed in England, it is voluntarism, this kind of public spirit. It integrates the individual and the state. It integrates the individual and the state through the individual's free will and through basing the state on the individual's participation. But a participation not just based on free will, but on education, on moral betterment, on respectability, but on moral betterment. Now, it's very typical that in your reading of Tom Brown, Tom Brown's father was a magistrate. And this worked best in England and least well in Germany because England had a tradition of voluntary participation through the justice of the peace, through the magistrate like Tom Brown's father, a voluntary tradition. Germany and Europe, the continent, had no such voluntary tradition of political participation, which Tocqueville thought was a great hindrance, and he was probably right. And as I said last time, that is why you only find in Anglo-Saxon nations, in England and America, what we might call the public spirit or public-spirited people, while that on the continent of Europe is almost totally unknown. There you are a civil servant, and that's it. And the state is still authority, and that's it. But there is none of this idea of voluntary participation, of public spirit, of entering into public office, which is, I think myself, one of the best and most praised noble legacies of liberalism I can possibly imagine. Now, together, therefore, with the politics goes, as you might say, a moral system. A moral system goes hand in hand with political action, the two pillars. And to this we must now turn. And turning to the moral system means turning to education. For liberalism took from the Enlightenment the centrality of education. And education really becomes central because through education you become worthy of political participation. Through education you become a Christian gentleman in England, like Tom Brown. And through education, liberalism wanted to build itself a political elite and did build itself a political elite, not only in England, but on the continent of Europe as well. Now, while there are a lot of common things about this liberal model of education, I want to take two very different ones, the German and the English. Both defined the bourgeois. And I want to turn to the German first, for in Germany a new word comes to the fore in the 19th century, early 19th century, a word that cannot be translated, but only that defined the word Bildung. And if you talk about the bourgeoisie in Germany, you talk about the Bildungsbürgertum, as some of you may know. You don't simply talk about the middle classes, you talk about the Bildungsbürger. We are all Bildungsbürger in the German sense. Now, what does this term mean? You cannot translate it with culture. And do not translate it with culture. It is much more than that. It was partly based on the Enlightenment and the classics. But the man who, more than anything else, founded that concept was Wilhelm von Humboldt, who in only 1 year, 1809 and 10, was the Prussian Minister of Education. But in that year, 1809 and 10, as Prussian Minister of Education, not only reformed Prussian education, which became the model of all German education, founded the new University of Berlin, which became the model then for other universities to follow. The new University of Berlin in 1810, but also really defined this new bourgeois idea of Bildung. It's already latent in Kant, of course, but it is Humboldt who really defined it. So what do we mean really by it? And we must translate it much longer than just by one phrase. It means really the harmonious development and refinement of personality through the study of the classics. The harmonious development and refinement of personality through the study of the classics. That's one thing it means. And the second thing it means is moral discernment based on the cultivation of reason. In other words, the refinement and harmonious personality is cultivated and furthered through both the study of classics, the ancients, and the cultivation of reason. Both the ancients and reason, you see the Enlightenment basis to all this. The idea behind it is that both learning and reason would lead to personal regeneration. But this personal regeneration, which would come from using your reason and from studying Plato and Aristotle and Cicero, which were really the three pillars of this education, Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero, was not learning for itself. When I have said Cicero, I already have given you a program, except you've never heard of Cicero. Some dogs are named Cicero, I'm told. What you have therefore here is this was to become involved in public life, to become, in the German sense, a new and more independent civil service. Humboldt reformed the German educational system, founded the University of Berlin to give Prussia people who would serve it with an independent mind, cultivated and refined on the basis of the study of the classics, which, remember, had just revived in the 18th century, and the cultivation of reason, but they are linked. They thought that if you studied the classics, you would cultivate your reason. And indeed, having still been through this education myself, the accusative, ablative, and the whole classical grammar, with which we were plagued, of course, terribly, is, of course, a refinement of reasons through its very condensation. The Latin irregular verb, which I spent my youth upon, sitting upon, sat on me, really. The Latin irregular verb is, of course, in a way, a training of reason. This is quite true, I suppose. I didn't see it that way at the time, believe me. But of course, it is a training of reason and the structure of classical grammar. But together with the philosophy of Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero is, of course, a training in the public spirit, the one available. It was, of course, in a sense, anti-Christian in that sense. Quite different than England, we shall come to it, quite different than Tom Brown. Secular and enlightened. Now, I might say now, this was not going to last in Germany. Eventually, this was infused with idealism rather than with Humboldt's rationalism. The idealist component became stronger. Eventually, instinct and soul were substituted for reason. And the classics were to speak to your instinct and soul, to your German instinct and soul. And eventually, studying the German past became as important as the classics. And the other pillar of that education became die Deutschstunde. The German lesson, or studying the Germanic past, really. So that became added, but that was not Humboldt's intention. But it became added, of course, as nationalism entered in Germany in the quest for unification very strongly in the wars of liberation. Now, in the last resort, this is based on self-development. And therefore, Humboldt made an innovation in the University of Berlin, which is going to last. Humboldt more or less invented what we call academic freedom. That is to say, the University of Berlin was the first university, based on the fact that the state must not interfere, that the process of learning must not be interfered with, because it was, after all, the development of your own personality, the refinement of your own personality on the basis of learning, and not on the basis of censorship or on the basis of outward pressures. Learning must be free. Learning must be free and independent. Otherwise, this idea of Bildung, of course, would not work at all. And that fitted in, of course, with the aspiration of the middle classes against the monarchy and of the aristocracy, that learning must be independent and academic freedom must prevail. Humboldt also reformed secondary school system. He founded the kind of school system which we call in Germany the humanist gymnasium. The humanist gymnasium. And the humanist gymnasium was based on the classics, the same thing, this secondary school system. But it was also already based on an elitism, an elite. The gymnasium was the first selection of refinement, and then the university. So if you went, the only way you could enter a German university until the 20th century was to go to a classical gymnasium. And whatever other school systems arose side by side later, it made no difference at all. It is only from a classical education that you could enter the university, not from any other kind of education. So it was a kind of a pyramid that must clear. Now, in secondary education, of course, this idea of freedom of learning did not work at all, because what Humboldt did not reform was the discipline in secondary education. So that, in a sense, you can say the weak spot of this whole system is that when young people came to the university, they were already in a way prejudiced against the classics by the kind of teaching that you know from the film Blue Angel, that we all went through, of course, the kind of teaching in secondary schools. And Humboldt aggravated that through something he did to teachers, namely the fact that as the secondary school system, the gymnasium, was to be upgraded, the teachers at the gymnasium also received the title of professors. They were, until after the Second World War in Germany, they were gymnasial professors, not university professors. Therefore, they were professors of the second rank, professors who hadn't made it, and therefore they took it out on their students, their frustration. They also wrote and so on, but they took it out on their students. It was a very bad idea to give them the title of professor, because they were obviously professor of the second rank, yes? And therefore, you got the kind of thing that you got in the Blue Angel, and that wasn't too good. But that is not what I want to stress here. By and large, what Humboldt had conceived, and which in England remained, really, a system independent of the state. Independent of the state. In Germany, never, of course, could remain so. The authoritarianism became much more built in Germany in certain ways, partly because of the wars of liberation, partly because the spirit of government in Germany was immediately tied up with nationalism, because all this was constructed during the wars of national liberation. England was already a unified nation, but here it was constructed in the wars of liberation. But the hope of von Humboldt and others behind it was the same. The hope behind it was quite the same. Let me quote again from you about this from the German historian Gervinus, the liberal historian, which I quoted from before, what he wrote in 1830. It's a typically liberal state. The world opens before our eyes. Every day brings new experiences. You see the acceptance of the Industrial Revolution here. Every day brings new experience. The gradual but inevitable ripening of Bildung in Europe is coming to fruition. Spiritual endeavors forcefully penetrate the existing order of things and envelop them, and by slowly learning the lesson of history and experience, despotism and obscurantism bow their heads. In other words, a very Enlightenment statement. The progress of Bildung will defeat despotism and obscurantism, will make progress possible, and by making progress possible, will make possible the rooting of parliamentary government, of free debate, of a government of laws and not of men. And Bildung depends on education, and education is central. And education then, as I said, is the classics and reason, except it more and more becomes really the classics and the German past. The classics and the German past. But it is this combined with the building of an elite, like in England, through the classical gymnasium and through the university, the building of an elite, after all, which the middle class will find not only its political edge, if you like, which in Germany, of course, it could never really make a breakthrough, would find its potential political edge, if you like, its potential political edge and its self-identification. As I said at the beginning, I must repeat, in Germany the bourgeoisie is not known simply as the bourgeoisie, but there is a distinction. There is the bourgeoisie that has never gone to a gymnasium and university, and then there is the Bildungsbürgertum, and the bourgeoisie that has never gone to the gymnasium and the university is sometimes called petty bourgeoisie, whatever that means. That's a very vague term. The true distinction isn't between the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie and the haute bourgeoisie. The true distinction is between those who went to gymnasium and university and the others. And this, of course, implies a distinction of wealth. None of these things were free. You had to pay. They were competitive. You had to have tutors. So that obviously the elite depends a judgment of wealth. And of course it does in England too, because all these things, whether the English public school or the German classical gymnasium and university, were expensive endeavors, extremely expensive endeavors. That must be clear. That is the clue distinction among the ruling classes. Now, I've said something about classics, but what about pietism? We said pietism was so strong in Germany. Now, in England, there's no difficulty. Obviously, one even superficial reading of Tom Browne will tell you how important evangelism was. And this was the idea of a Christian gentleman. But Germans did not become Christian gentlemen. They became Bildungsbürger. English became Christian gentlemen. But where then is pietism? And the answer is pietism was absorbed by nationalism, don't forget. And In England, evangelism was not absorbed by nationalism to that extent, because nationalism in England was not an issue. It was not an issue. In Germany, it was an issue. So in Germany, you do not become Christian gentlemen. You become, if you like, good Germans. A Bildungsbürger is a good German as well. That goes by definition. A Bildungsbürger is a good German as well. And indeed, there is a lot in this education of the classics and learning that comes from Pietism. Not eventually the German, the emphasis on the German lesson, the emphasis on the German lesson, which is a lesson of the German past. If you think of Germanistik and the German history and Germanistik, then don't think of it in anything else, but in nationalist sense, that's what it was. It was a nationalist sense. Now, in England, of course, you did not have this, and this wasn't the idea. But the idea of John Wesley of work, pray, and save was also involved in German bourgeois education. That is to say, the idea of respectability, the idea of self-control is very obvious in this idea. And the idea of discipline. Self-control you got in the end not so much through Humboldt's idea of personal refinement, but through the stick in the gymnasium. I was beaten last and publicly when I was 18, and a damn good thing it was for me too. I'm not opposed to that at all. It gives you a sense of belonging, if nothing else. I'm not opposed at all. It was very good. I deserved thoroughly to be beaten, and I was beaten all my youth. I deserved it, believe me, every single one. I was beaten last at 18. So self-control was not really a matter of individual refinement. It was, of course, a matter of discipline. It's easily confused with discipline in any case. And given what I said about teachers, it was a matter of discipline, of discipline. So that, on the whole, that change must be clear. But what were you disciplined for? You were disciplined for study, yes? And eventually, of course, everything declines. So the studies of classics was the study of the irregular verb. It became more or less rote learning. Therefore, it had to be spanked into you, if I can put it that way, yes? And that was a damn good thing, too, because we got a little discipline, yes, and self-control, and all of that thing, which many of you sadly lack. So that this was a damn good thing. I'm very grateful, actually. I mean it seriously, for the education I got. I think it was a very good thing for me. So that what you had, therefore, was discipline. Self-discipline. And you had to learn. Learning was not fun, this absurd idea, learning is fun. Is it not fun at all? Why should it be fun? The absurdity is, yes, if you want fun, go to a toy store. Yes, but universities in America have become toy stores. We all know that. So it's not supposed to be fun. It's pain. So nothing is worth it that isn't pain with. Obviously. So what you have, therefore, then is nothing about this American idea of instant satisfaction and all this sort of stuff which you were brought up, the so-called progressive education, that's led to unprogressive ignorance. I'm saying that because that'll go out to the state on the radio, don't forget. it's certainly worth making this point. I feel very strongly about it after 40 years in American universities. So that what you have, therefore, is discipline. And you have it in Tom Brown, too. So that, for all the liberal freedom, in a sense you can say liberal gave you freedom and it took it away. Because when you talk about free debate and all of these things, what one always forgets is there is conformity in manners and morals, conformity in respectability. And that the elite is built through self-discipline and control, which is self-control, which is a part of respectability. which is the essence of liberal harmony. So you must never confuse liberal with freedom in the sense that it is, you know, that it is free debate and free discussion and all this kind of freedom. In the reality, it's based on a doctrine of self-control. And this whole learning is a doctrine of self-control. Now, respectability, of course, is very much involved in that. In Germany, in France, and everywhere, as part of the self-definition of the middle class, the heritage, remember, of the heritage of pietism and evangelism and good manners, good behavior, respectability, are all now of great importance. Remember that. Not only in Tom Brown, we shall come back to it, but I would say generally in pietism, in everything. Now, I've said something about Germany. But I must mention that in France you have the same middle class elite building. The same structured education. You have first something that is very old in France, the Grande École, the great schools, Henry IV and Louis le Grand, which you can still see at the Place Odéon in Paris. You can still see them, which date back. But which become more and more, as it were, like the Humanistische Gymnasium in Germany, a place for the education of the elite, the Grande École. And after the Grande École, you have founded in the French Revolution what we call the elite universities in France. The elite universities open to competition now. That is to say, middle class competition. Famous, the École Normale, of course, which becomes the elite school in France. The École Normale, the elite university. But together, of course, with the École Polytechnique, with the École de l'Administration, these three schools, these three universities, the Polytechnique, the University for Administration, if you like, and the École Normale will be to this day in France the training ground for the French elite, whether it is the civil servants or indeed the political elite. It's very structured in France. And of course you have then in France also the lycée, the Reformation and the lycée, together with the Grande École as the first step to the elite universities. Now, to summarize then, in France as much as in England and in Germany, you have education now is forming a new middle class elite. In France and Germany at times, this middle class elite will become the political elite. In Germany, it will never really become the political elite till 1918, because before that, the king and the king, emperor, aristocracy still played the crucial part. But in Germany, nonetheless, the middle class elite will become the civil service. The civil service, yes. But unlike France and England, it will not really become the political elite. That is a great difference, because in England the middle class also will become the political elite. Not in Germany, not till 1918, really. But it becomes the civil service, and the civil service is extremely important. It isn't that the, it is so important that, for example, if you went to, through this elite education in Germany, to a Humanistische Gymnasium and the university, you only had to do 1 year's military service, and that immediately an officer status. In other words, even in military service, which was universal service, you were saved almost 2 years of it, and you immediately entered the army as an officer. So the elite building was recognized, as it were, by the establishment, by the aristocratic establishment, by the establishment as well, through this military service. And indeed, to be a lieutenant of the reserve in Germany became a kind of bridge between the middle classes and the political elite, that is, the aristocracy and the court. To be a lieutenant of the reserve became extremely important as a sign that you had gone through this kind of education, that you were a part of the elite. If you, even if you were not a part of the political governing classes, even if those remained very largely in Germany in the hands of the court and the aristocracy. Therefore, all this business of the lieutenant of the reserve, which Jews could never become, and therefore the lieutenant of the reserve was a very important, important matter of prestige. Now, with all of this said, the differences then between Germany and England and France are not a difference in elite building. It's not really a difference of elite structures. It's not even so much a difference in the aim of education, which is really in the last resort not an aim of learning, but the use of learning for character building. Yes? As I said, refinement of reason in Humboldt's terms, character building in the terms of England. The aim is really an aim of character building, really. To be sure, this elite worked everywhere. In England, it's a network of old boys. As you know, and I'll come back to that, unless you went to the right public schools and the right colleges in Oxford and Cambridge, you had no chance. The first English prime minister ever not to be from that was Harold Wilson in the 1960s. Before the 1960s, all English prime ministers were from the big public school and most from Eton. So it was. And in Germany, you can almost do the same because the fraternities at the universities played the same role in Germany as the colleges in Oxford and Cambridge. It was the same old boys network. And of course, as you know, the world is ruled by old boys. He says university is ruled by old boys. Everything is ruled by old boy networks. And therefore, an elite without an old boy network doesn't really work, I think. But here in Germany, in France, of course, as well, from the Grande École and the École Normale, this was an old boys network. In England, from Eton, Rugby, we'll talk about that. The other schools, Cambridge and Oxford is an old boys network. In Germany, from the Humanistische Gymnasium to the fraternities, the right proper fraternities, made an old boys network. And these old boys networks dominated the civil service, and they dominated the political elites in those countries as well, yes? They dominated all these kind of institutions. What you call the ruling classes, and is really an old boys network. That's what the ruling classes are, really. And an old boys network is made cohesive by this liberal idea, middle class self-definition, liberal ideas of education of this nature. Now, it was much less dense in Germany than in England. This is quite true. By and large, in England, as you know, perhaps to this day, the friendships, and they were all male friendships, I'll come back to that at the end, the male friendships made at Oxford and Cambridge last through life. Most Englishmen of the ruling classes, ruling elites, never make many new friends after school in Oxford and Cambridge. You went to your school from my school, you went to Emmanuel College, the Puritan college in Cambridge, to which I went. And from then on, your friendships were set. Now, in Germany, it wasn't quite that way, because German education, unlike English education, wasn't a boarding school education. And of course, that makes a great deal of co-difference in two ways. First of all, in the kind of male-centered education in England, a boarding school education, a male-centered education. And in Germany, it was not a boarding school education. That makes a great deal of difference, after all, in the kind of elite and old boys. So that, while I would say in Germany, too, your fraternity friendships were dominant, really, for a long time in the old boy network, it was still wider. And of course, in the German educational system, you met girls. But in the English educational system, you didn't meet girls at all. You met them in vacation, perhaps. That's all. But you were rigidly kept separate, rigidly separate. This will, I think, be very important for the kind of ruling elite you're going to get in England in the end. Extremely important and different. And of course, in France, it was totally different as well. There also, it wasn't a completely male society at all, this kind of ruling elite, as it was, let us say, in England. So the friendships Tom Brown made at Rugby, which is the school at Rugby, and which he would then make, let us say, he would go to Oxford or Cambridge, according whether from Rugby you went to Oxford or Cambridge. That goes by school. And the college goes by school, too. So let us say people from Rugby, I've forgotten, go to Cambridge, not to Oxford, I think. And by and large, I think they go to King's Cambridge, but I'm not sure. Anyway, that would last. He would go with the same class to university, to Cambridge, to the same college in Cambridge, and that would be set for life. And these other people would be his friends, and they would help each other in the civil service or in parliament or whatever. It would be the old boys' network, which is the ruling network, quite clearly here. A very, as it were, coherent elite which you have. Now, having said all that, let us then come to England. Let us come to Tom Brown, and I want to say some more thing more before you go. And let us come to Tom Brown, and let me please urge you to read Tom Brown.